From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Terry Gilday. Donald Trump is capturing the hearts and minds of a voter base across the country that continues to grow. The business mogul and reality TV star both excites and infuriates people with his promises to build a wall on the Mexican border or ban all Muslims from entering the United States. Journalist Amanda Taub says that the bizarre and often extreme ideas that Trump offers up go beyond the presidential candidate. She asserts that Trump represents a group of people in this country who look for strong leaders, who promise to take whatever action necessary to protect them from outsiders and prevent the changes they fear. She believes the movement is just beginning and could last well beyond a possible Trump presidency. Amanda Taub and the rise of American authoritarianism after the news.
Connected with KUER throughout the day on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. We'll bring you stories from our local news team along with program updates and features from NPR, BBC, and other network providers. Get the scoop on upcoming events, meet your favorite public radio personalities, and find out what's happening at the station behind the scenes by following KUER on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
This is Radio West. I'm Terry Gilday, in for Doug Fabrizio. Donald Trump's support among voters continues to grow. The frontrunner for the Republican presidential nomination had another strong showing in yesterday's primary contests. Trump handily took most states, including Florida, forcing Senator Marco Rubio to suspend his bid for the White House. With Trump's announcement that he would not attend a debate next week in Salt Lake City, Fox News canceled the debate altogether. While the scenario of a contested party convention this summer is still possible, establishment Republicans are bracing themselves for the very real possibility that Trump will carry the flag of the GOP into the general election this November. The voters Trump attracts are a passionate group, concerned about the direction of our country. While critics condemn Trump's call for a ban on Muslims or the construction of a border wall as racism and bigotry, a growing number of his supporters are defending the candidate. The passion is becoming so palpable that altercations and violence are almost routine at rallies. Trump is no doubt feeding that passion, sometimes praising if not encouraging aggressive behavior. Journalist Amanda Taub says Donald Trump represents a growing movement in this country where people driven by their fear and anger are seeking a strong man leader, one that will take whatever action necessary to protect them from outsiders and prevent societal changes they fear. In her article about the rise of American authoritarianism for Vox.com, Taub reports the findings of a number of political scientists who have identified a growing trend of authoritarian sentiment in the country, one that may grow for years to come. We're talking about the rise of authoritarianism on the show today with Amanda Taub, and you can join us too. Our phone number is 801-585-WEST. That's 801-585-9378. You can email us at radiowest@kuer.org, and you can also contact us on Facebook and on Twitter. Amanda Taub is a former human rights lawyer who now covers foreign policy, human rights, and social justice for Vox.com. She joins us today from a studio in Washington, D.C. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So, Amanda, let's take a moment to define authoritarianism as you and these political scientists are observing it. What are we talking about here?
So there are really two sides to authoritarianism as political scientists discuss it. So the first most important part that they're discussing is a political disposition that certain people have. It's pretty common where they really strongly prize order. They believe in preserving hierarchies and stability. And when they feel that social change is disturbing that order or changing the hierarchies that they prioritize, they are willing to support what researchers think of as the action side of authoritarianism. And that is strongman leaders and harsh punitive policies that promise to prevent or reverse the changes that they fear. And very, very often, that kind of authoritarian leadership means focusing on what political scientists call outgroups, basically minorities, immigrants, religious groups that are sort of scapegoated as being the source of the problems that these people fear. And so if you were going to create in a lab a leader who could fit the authoritarian movement for U.S. politics, it might be somebody who looks a lot like Donald Trump. He's clearly got his a really keen sense of what people are worried about and is very, very good at manipulating that for political gain.
So in your article, you and a group of political scientists are uncovering this trend, but it's kind of a delicate methodology that they use. I mean, you can't walk up to someone and say, are you a racist? Are you a bigot? There has to be a certain kind of methodology where you can sort of uncover these trends. Talk to me about that methodology. What were some of the questions that the political scientists used in the survey to uncover this this sentiment?
So it's a very clever thing that they came up with, because you're absolutely right that a lot of the questions, if asked directly about authoritarian policies, would be too sensitive in order for people to really answer them honestly. So what they do instead is they ask a series of four questions about people's parenting preferences, what they think is most important in child rearing. And really what these questions do is they're a way to get people to talk about whether they value order and authority more, or things like creativity and independence more. So there are questions like, which one is more important for a child to have, independence or respect for their elders? Another question is, which is more important for a child to be, considerate or well-behaved? And the great thing about these questions is you're asking people to choose between two things that everybody values to some extent. Nobody is going to hear these questions and think, oh, obviously one of these answers would suggest I'm a bad person, so I'm going to avoid it, or would be kind of socially unacceptable. But by asking these four questions, it turns out you can get a very clear profile of the degree to which somebody supports these kind of authoritarian policy preferences and authoritarian candidates.
So you mentioned a little bit about this in your initial answer, but what about Trump embodies these authoritarian ideals? I mean, of course, we know he's a business mogul who claims his own success most of the time. He's got a celebrity presence. But you talk about value of authority. What about Trump embodies that, do you think?
So Stanley Feldman, who's one of the academic researchers I worked with on this article, describes the classic authoritarian leadership style as simple, powerful, and punitive. And I think that that's really Trump to a T. You know, he always says things in the most straightforward, short, direct manner. You know, everything is the best this, the best that. He's very focused on power. And he's very punitive. A lot of his, you know, to the extent he has a policy platform, a lot of it is focused on identifying people who are kind of at fault for what he claims are America's problems, whether it's trade with China or the threat from Muslim immigrants and Syrian refugees or unauthorized immigrants. And he's very punitive. I mean, he's promising a immigration policy that would not only be harsh on enforcement with this big wall that he's promising, but he is talking about deporting millions of people from this country who are the family members of American citizens.
Trump's obviously taking some authoritarian ideals from other world leaders in the country. Vladimir Putin certainly comes to mind. Who are some of those other authoritarians around the world that are in power now, and how do you think they're influencing the way that Trump interacts with voters?
It's really hard to say who might be influencing him specifically. He certainly does seem to have some positive feelings towards President Putin of Russia, who absolutely also embodies this leadership style. But I think the really kind of key thing to know about this is that it's not necessarily about particular people being role models of this particular style. It's about the fact that this style works for people. And so if you have a country that's at a moment of kind of instability and change where a lot of people are feeling insecure and worried, they are very willing to support this kind of strong leader. So I think that if, you know, Trump is in some ways acting like Putin, that's not necessarily because he's studied Putin's ways and tried to copy them. It's because the same kinds of feelings among the citizenry are fueling the same kind of leadership style.
going back to the methodology for a second, I find it fascinating that the political scientists in the study were asking questions about parenting skills. I'm a parent, and I know that when you're trying to solve a problem with a 5-year-old or a 7-year-old, you're very direct about it. There's a problem, and then there's a solution, and you impose that solution oftentimes on the child. And of course, as children get older and develop, you have to rework your parenting style, right? But is that what authoritarians are looking for? I guess the question is, I mean, do they want a dictator like a parent? Do they even know if that's what they want? I mean, they obviously are see problems that need to be fixed in this country. They want someone to point out what those problems are and some easy solutions that can, with a very easy path to get to those solutions. What do authoritarians really want here?
Yeah, so I think what I would say is less that it makes less sense to think about this as them looking for a parent and more sense to think about it as there's really a universal human yearning when we feel very scared to have somebody who is strong enough to make it all okay promise that they will do that. And so with children, that's absolutely apparent. But I think that it's not something we necessarily leave behind in childhood. It's just that for the most part, as we grow to adulthood, we become more capable of coping with various different kinds of fears on our own. But what the research in authoritarianism really shows is that when people are very frightened, this is the kind of leadership they'll turn to. One of the things that I found most interesting when researching this article is that while there is a large subset of people who you could think of as authoritarian voters who have this kind of basic set of psychological and political preferences, it turns out that when non-authoritarians are scared enough, they will also support or at least become more likely to support authoritarian candidates and policies. So, for instance, researchers find that after a major terrorist attack, there tends to be a spike in support for authoritarian policies. So I think really what that shows is that there's something comforting to people about this kind of leadership style. And I think that should make us very worried about what it might mean for this country's policies and politics at a time of economic stress, at a time when people are afraid of terrorism, and at a time of great social change, which is clearly really unsettling to a large portion of the citizenry.
So have the events of the last 15 years contributed to this? I mean, if we look at the events of 9/11, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the rise of ISIS out of that, the unrest in the world, I guess my question is, do you think Republicans planted the seeds for this when they were using 9/11 and national security as a centerpiece in the campaigns of 2004 and 2008?
I think there's certainly some truth to that. We've absolutely seen since 9/11 pretty constant references to fear and danger in the media. And it's not just general fear and danger. It is this idea that there are kind of bad people outside the United States who want to hurt Americans and that we need to take really extreme action to protect ourselves. But I think there's also something else going on here, which is that for the past several decades in this country, we've seen really significant social change. So it started with the Civil Rights Act, moving through, the ERA, Equal Rights for Women. More recently, we've had things like same-sex marriage becoming legal. And for people who are concerned about social change and generally committed to traditional values as a way of kind of preserving the status quo, that has been very unsettling. And those changes have been cumulative. It's not as if we've kind of made some progress and then turned it back again. There's been progress in one area and then another and then another. And the Republican Party has really positioned itself as opposing those changes. And I think that's been very appealing for authoritarian voters who over the past several decades have become more and more Republican. But I think at the same time, that's led to a sense of frustration because the Republican Party has essentially been promising to oppose these kind of changes, but they haven't been able to prevent them.
Amanda, going back to what you're talking about through the history of these movements, I think that Trump is Trump's candidacy can be easily compared to Barry Goldwater's candidacy of the 1960s. And I guess my question is, you sort of said that this has been rising for several decades. I guess my question is this just a part of the political cultural process that we find ourselves in? Is this elliptical rather than something that's been linearly growing for a long period of time?
That's a difficult question to answer, but from the research that I've looked at, it really seems like there is actually a linear pattern here. So these authoritarian voters used to be very evenly distributed across the Democratic and Republican parties. But over the past few decades, as I mentioned, they have been filtering into the Republican Party. And what that means is they're becoming a bigger and bigger constituency, and they have more and more power within the party. But the Republican Party elites have not really been kind of giving that constituency what they want. And so I think there's what we're seeing now is as a result of that relatively slow and probably unintentional progression over time, there's now a really serious split within the GOP between kind of traditional conservative policy ideas that are more focused on economic policy and these social issues, which are much more appealing to authoritarian voters.
Amanda Taub is a journalist joining us today on the program. She reports for Vox.com, and we're talking about her new article, The Rise of American Authoritarianism. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Terry Gilday in for Doug Fabrizio. Our guest is Amanda Taub. She's a journalist for Vox.com, and we're talking about her new article, The Rise of American Authoritarianism, and how that's affecting Donald Trump's presidential campaign. Amanda, I want to talk about something that is linked in the news a lot with Donald Trump these days. It's his comparison to infamous world leaders like Adolf Hitler that are connected to bigotry. It's now routine that Trump is compared to Hitler, and he's drawn some public support from members of the Ku Klux Klan, but supporters don't seem to be swayed by those comparisons. Why is that? What element of authoritarianism allows people to discount those ideas or even defend them in some way?
So I think there are a couple of things going on there. One is that while there are obviously huge differences between Trump and somebody like Hitler, it's not a coincidence that authoritarianism as a political science area of study was something that was first came up after World War II. This began as a way to study how leaders like Hitler came to power. And that's why it really focuses on the supporters rather than the leaders themselves. The political scientists who study this really think that the key to understanding how leaders like that can take power and how they can pursue such extreme and frightening policies is to look at what the situation is with their supporters and what those people believe, what they're feeling, what drives them to support these kind of leaders. And really what it comes down to over and over is fear, and in particular, fear of outsiders. So I don't think it's a coincidence that Trump is saying that the problems in this country come from unauthorized immigrants, or the problems in this country come from Muslim immigrants, or, you know, any of the other groups that he's targeting. It's a way to suggest not only that the problem is kind of the fault of somebody else, but that somebody else can be isolated and dealt with, that they can be kept out with a wall, that they can be deported, etc. So I think that's why there are some of these comparisons drawn so routinely in the press, because there are some disturbing parallels between the kind of emotions behind this candidacy, even though as individual people go, they're very different. And I think that it's important to not ignore that. You know, it's I think, easy to get caught up in the question of, you know, is it reasonable or is it not reasonable to compare Trump and Hitler, when really the more important question is what's going on in this country that is making people support these kind of policies.
So if fear is the root that leads people to hatred, anger, or authoritarian action, Can a person be authoritarian without being a racist or a bigot? We got a tweet from Tamitha here. She said, authoritarianism is just a pretty word for xenophobia, bigotry, lack of education, and hatred. I guess my question is, can you be authoritarian on some level, consciously or subconsciously, and not be a racist, a bigot?
Yes, absolutely. So there are a couple of things going on here. One is that not all authoritarians are supporting these kind of policies all the time. So there's this theory called activation, which basically says that authoritarianism can be latent. It can be something that somebody might have this kind of disposition, but it doesn't necessarily affect their politics until something happens to make them feel frightened enough that they really seek out this kind of strong leader. And the other thing I would say is that the way that this manifests pretty clearly depends a lot on the leaders who are taking advantage of it. So I don't think it's a coincidence that Donald Trump is targeting out-groups. But I also think that he bears a lot of responsibility for focusing people's fears on the groups that he's targeting.
Donald Trump said in an interview earlier this week that if nominated, he would change his behavior in some way, that he would move closer to the center. We've heard Republicans say this before, not in as dramatic a fashion, but Mitt Romney, when he was running in 2012, talked about having to run too far to the right and then sort of center your campaign for the general election. Is it even possible for Trump to shift his authoritarian views into a more middle center or center middle kind of ideology if he does become the GOP nominee or ends up running as an independent?
You know, if there's one thing I've learned as a journalist over the last few months trying to cover Donald Trump is to never say never, because he certainly has managed to confound a lot of expectations. So it's possible that he could shift to the middle. But I'm really not sure that that would be an effective strategy for him, because he has great popularity with a very particular base of Republican voters, and he's very unpopular with everyone else. So there was a poll yesterday that came out that found there's not a single state where a majority of people think that Trump is trustworthy. He has extremely high unfavorable ratings, and it's difficult to imagine how he could have success in changing that without losing the base that he already has. Because really, the core of his appeal to those people is that he's willing to do what they like to think of as, you know, throw away political correctness, but what is really kind of using terrifyingly disrespectful and cruel language towards a host of vulnerable groups in this country.
I think it's easy for people to see Trump's supporters as almost exclusively white male, but more and more I'm seeing women turning out for his rallies. Mm-hmm. Why is authoritarianism resonating with women maybe in a different way than with men?
It's hard to say if there's an element that is kind of newly resonating with women, but I would say that there's no particular reason why this isn't something that could appeal to women as well. You know, as I said, this is really about fear and insecurity, and in particular, insecurity about kind of frightening new changes to their communities, to their standing in this country. And I think that for a lot of particularly white Americans, they have over the last few years kind of woken up to a new reality where white people will eventually not be a majority in this country. White privilege no longer carries the power that it once did. And I think that at the very least, that feels uncertain and confusing to a lot of people who've never really had to think about it before. And to some people, it feels genuinely frightening. That's not something that's limited to men.
If Donald Trump is able to capture this authoritarian fear, this fear of societal changes, of immigrants entering this country, of a redefinition of traditional marriage, of the possibility of terrorist attacks on American soil, even economic fears, what can his opponents do, both as Republicans and Democrats? Mostly Democrats here, I think, because we've heard Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders condemn Donald Trump for violence at rallies and his bigoted statements. But what can they do to get to these voters who are having this fear and try in some way reach that fear and subside it in some way, shape, or form, or pull them over to a more sensible idea of what a candidate could and should be?
So I wish I had a simple answer for that. It's something that I have asked the experts who I worked with on my article, and unfortunately, they didn't have any particularly reassuring answers for me. Because once people are afraid, it can be very difficult to calm their fears. What Mark Hetherington, who's one of the experts I spoke to, did say is that over time, people can become more comfortable with certain types of social changes, and also that it could be possible to counteract Trump's kind of fear-laden, punitive politics with a more kind of calm and relaxed political style. He said that this is something he's really seen President Obama focusing on doing, which is that at times of kind of social conflict and very heated moments about what's happening in this country, Obama is very likely to say, you know, let's just sit down. Everybody stay calm. This is going to be okay. So I think that that is a possibility. But I would also say that it's not that simple. You know, when we did a poll in connection with my article, and a lot of people scored very highly on authoritarianism. And they also told us in response to a series of questions that they're very worried about the direction this country is taking in terms of social changes like same-sex marriage becoming legal. And they're also very afraid of threats to this country like those posed by the government of Iran, those posed by terrorist organizations like ISIS. And it's a little bit difficult to see what could change their mind anytime soon.
Let's talk a little bit about the rise of violence at Trump's rallies. In a companion article that you published on Vox.com just a few days ago, you said the problem of violence starts with Trump himself. It's been going on a while and getting worse. Talk to me about that. It's obvious that Trump is feeding off of the anger that's welling over into violence. But why is Trump himself the problem of it, the center of it?
So Trump himself, I think, is absolutely responsible for a lot of what is happening at his rallies, because if you listen to what he's saying, he's really encouraging it. I mean, he at a rally in Iowa at the beginning of February said to his supporters, you know, if you see anyone who seems like they might be about to throw a tomato, you should punch them. Just a couple of days ago, he was talking about how, you know, the problem with protesting now is that there used to be consequences for protesting and there should still be consequences. And in context, he really made it seem like he thought that people should be punished for appearing at his rallies to protest what he's saying, when, of course, actually, you know, protest is a core element of free speech in this country, and publicly expressing dissenting views is something that's, you know, always been part of our politics. And I think that what he is doing with that is, first of all, it's another example of this kind of very strong, punitive political style. So it's very appealing to his supporters. And he's also telling them that they are essentially the victims here, that they are the ones who are under attack and they need to take extreme action to protect themselves. That was very much the rhetoric that he used around his rally in Chicago being canceled, for instance, that, you know, their rights were being infringed. They needed to do something about it. And I think it was absolutely what was implied by the tweet he sent to about Bernie Sanders supporters, in which he essentially implied that his supporters might come and be violent at Bernie Sanders rallies. So what he said is, you know, Bernie Sanders is lying when he said his disruptors aren't told to go to my events. Be careful, Bernie, or my supporters will go to yours. That's not an explicit threat, but in context, it's pretty frightening.
It is. And there's a bit of an irony here where Trump is talking about his freedom of expression, his freedom to express his emotions and his thoughts at his rallies, whether they incite violence or not. And for him, that's debatable. For others, it's not. But I wonder if there's sort of a stick with me here for a second, a reverse authoritarianism happening. There are fears that are quelling around the people who don't support Trump about what he is talking about. He's talking about quelling the freedom of expression. He's talking about tailoring the First Amendment, the freedom of the press. And we've seen ordinary individuals and celebrities come out with long, verbose emails and Facebook posts about why to not support Trump. Louis C.K. comes to mind, and the mm-hmm. gentleman who runs the very popular Facebook page, Humans of New York. Can there be a reverse authoritarianism here, or a response to that fear that could impede the Trump campaign in some way?
So I think that it could absolutely be true that Trump's kind of fiery rhetoric and his, you know, xenophobia, the harsh, bigoted comments he's made about various groups could absolutely inspire people to come out and vote and support whoever runs against him in a general election. And so I think that this is something that really points to the reason why authoritarianism could be a real problem for the Republican Party, because it is extremely appealing to what is pretty clearly a large minority within the Republican Party, but it's really alienating to people who don't agree with it. And so I think that that is something that could cause real problems for the GOP in the long term, because there's no reason to believe that Donald Trump is going to be the last Trump they deal with. If he doesn't get elected, he's already proven that this can be a very effective political style. And so I think we should expect to see more Trumps in American politics.
So is that the inevitable future of the GOP, that they will attract more individuals like Trump for years to come, even if Trump isn't elected president? I guess that here in Salt Lake City, we're still coming off of the speech from Mitt Romney on our campus here just a few weeks ago, which really sort of codified in everyone's mind what everyone knew was happening, but Republicans were denying, that there was a civil war inside the Republican Party over the authoritarian ideals of Trump and the party trying to save itself. I guess my question is the GOP too late to stop Trump? Is the GOP too late to stop this authoritarian sentiment that is running rampant through their party?
I think to a large extent it is too late. This is something that has been building up in the Republican Party for decades because of their stance on social issues. They've been attracting these voters. And until now, they've been able to more or less hold their coalition together by kind of taking some action on social issues, but being moderate in other ways, and using that as a way to also develop a kind of voting base that supports their economic policies. But I think what we're seeing now is that those political platforms now have too much space between them, and the math no longer works out. The authoritarian voter bloc now has enough power within the party that they're not willing to just be kind of a junior partner in the coalition. One thing that I think is really interesting is to compare this to the political systems in a lot of European countries that have had similar types of political movements spring up, but there they fuel third parties. So they might fuel something like the UK Independence Party in the United Kingdom, or the Front National in France. And that allows these types of authoritarian voters and people who, for whatever reason, share their sentiments to support these third parties. And it doesn't necessarily tear apart their existing major political parties. But here in the U.S., that hasn't happened. And so instead, you have kind of the GOP containing two different political parties. And as a result, it's at war with itself.
And how long can they sustain that before some party grows out of it? We've sort of seen that with the Tea Party, right? Even though the Tea Party aligns themselves with Republicans, Ted Cruz personifies that. Our own Senator Mike Lee from Utah here personifies that in lots of ways. Yet they've been able to connect themselves with the part of the Republican Party. But I actually almost see that as the beginning fracture of the Republican Party. So can it be sustained, or are we on an inevitable course of a third party here?
I wouldn't say we're on an inevitable course to a third party, though I certainly think it's a very likely possibility that could happen here. But I think you are absolutely right to bring up the Tea Party, because what that shows is that even if in some ways the party was able to have success growing out of the Tea Party, you know, they did win a lot of seats, a lot of Tea Party related and supported politicians have made it into office, that has turned out to be a problem when it comes time to govern, because the Republican Party doesn't have the same kind of power it might in a parliamentary system to kind of control its members. And when you have real serious differences between the policy platforms of different people within your party, it becomes harder and harder to control party politics in Congress and the Senate. And it also becomes harder and harder to win the presidency because you have to appeal to the entire country in a national election.
And we've certainly seen examples of that in Congress with Tea Party individuals infiltrating the House and the Senate and upsetting the Republican establishment there. Let's go to a couple of questions on social media here. We got a question from Brian in Midvale. He says, it seems like topics that were once considered not okay to support publicly, he has in parentheses here, overt racism, for example, have been given a voice. How does that mesh with the idea of authoritarianism?
I think that's a great question, because one thing that I hear from Trump supporters is that they feel like their voices have been suppressed. You know, one thing that people very often say when they're explaining their support for Trump is they're saying, I think he's just saying what everyone is thinking and they just can't say because of political correctness. So I think it turns out that there are a lot of people in this country who think that the problem is that we're not allowed to talk about those things anymore, rather than the problem being bigotry or misogyny or xenophobia. And Trump has managed to tap into a lot of people who really feel that way. And so when he is willing to talk about those topics publicly and say those things publicly, not only does it not hurt his support, it makes him look like a bold truth teller.
Here's a good follow-up question to that. This is from Dave in Salt Lake City. He writes, Trump ran for president in 2012 but didn't gain any traction then. Why is he so popular this time around? What's changed?
That is a very good question. You know, as you know, when Trump didn't have the success in 2012, that led to him kind of being written off this time around. But I think that a few different things are going on here. One is that you can see the Republican Party itself is that much more fractured. Another is that this process, this rise of authoritarianism has in the meantime, I think, been growing, both because of this kind of slow progression over time of people filtering into the Republican Party, but also because we've had that many more years of the kind of politics of fear that you talked about earlier. If you turn on cable news, you're almost certainly guaranteed to see a story about something you should be afraid of. And in the past few years, that has become particularly pointed when it comes to Islamophobia, so targeting Muslims, and also when it comes to stories on undocumented immigrants. And I think that that has really helped build up support for Trump by having this kind of activating effect on authoritarian voters. So in our survey for my article, we asked questions about some of these issues. You know, for instance, we asked our respondents whether they thought it was good for the country, bad for the country, or neutral for Muslims to be building mosques in American cities. And the more authoritarian people were, the more likely they were to say that that was bad for the country. And I think that that is something that's really been reinforced in the past few years by the media.
We're speaking with Amanda Taub. She's a reporter for Vox.com, and we're talking about her new article, The Rise of American Authoritarianism, and how that's affecting Donald Trump's campaign. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. Let's take a quick break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West. I'm Terry Gilday in for Doug Fabrizio. My guest today is Amanda Taub. She's a reporter for Vox.com, and we're talking about Donald Trump's candidacy and her article, The Rise of American Authoritarianism. Let's go to another quick question here. This is from Mike from Sandy. He says, the demography of Democrats who support Trump, is there some economic argument that he's making that appeals to Democrats? There are undoubtedly some Democrats who hold some racist ideas, he says, but is there anything about Trump that appeals to Democrats? There probably are some out there who might identify with Trump, I suppose.
I think that's certainly possibly true. I would say that one of the things that we're seeing here is a kind of general decline of the importance of party politics in American life. I think more and more Americans are saying that they're independents rather than affiliating themselves with a particular party. And so I think that there is some general dissatisfaction with the Democratic Party as well as the Republican Party. I think you might be right that economic issues could be affecting this. But one thing I would point out is that even though authoritarians are, for the most part, Republican, it's become much more likely over the years that they are affiliated with that party. There are authoritarians in the Democratic Party. And there, it's easy to see how Trump might be appealing to those voters for the same kinds of reasons.
Of course, Francis Underwood from House of Cards, a fictional authoritarian, is a Democrat on TV. That's an interesting interpretation of authoritarianism. Let's go to another question. This is from Dan in Salt Lake City. He says, I've noticed a bit of an overlap between Donald Trump and former Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi. I wonder if there's anything to learn from that democratic country's experience with a strongman leader and what we might be in store for if Trump manages to get elected president.
I think that there certainly are overlaps between Trump and Berlusconi. There are definitely some stylistic similarities, if nothing else. And Berlusconi was also a businessman. He was also somebody who had a huge kind of media presence separately and before his political career. I don't know if there are a huge number of direct parallels that we can draw between Trump and Berlusconi, because the Italian political system is very different from ours, and the role of political parties is very different. But I think the key observation there is really this isn't something that's unique to Trump. It's not even something that's unique to the United States. It's a phenomenon that we've seen around the world time and time again. And that means that it's something that we should pay attention to here. This isn't just a fluke. This is a type of politics that really works and has before.
I want to get back to the violence that continues to escalate at Trump's rallies. Of course, he called out Bernie Sanders, I think calling him our friendly communist, sort of trying to paint progressive protesters as the people who are inciting violence. I guess my question is, how can Sanders and Hillary Clinton reach out to the reporters and respond to that? I mean, should they be asking them to in some way mitigate protesting, or should the candidates be acknowledging that or rebuffing those statements from Trump? I mean, what is a way for Democrats to engage those kinds of claims that Trump is making?
So I think it's absolutely true that those candidates should be criticizing what are essentially calls for political violence. You know, that is not the way we do things here in this country. And I think that at a very fundamental level, it's really wrong for people to feel intimidated from supporting a political candidate or participating in, you know, peaceful expressions of free speech by the threat of violence. That's not how we should be organizing politics in this country. As to the question of whether there's anything that Sanders or Clinton could do to actually prevent this kind of violence from breaking out, I'm really not sure there is. You know, certainly while criticizing Trump's calls for violence, they should be reiterating that their supporters should not engage in the same thing. But what Trump has done is really equated peaceful protest with a type of violence. You know, he has talked about it as if it is such a threat that it is reasonable and necessary to meet it with violence. And he's even promised to pay the legal fees of people who attack protesters at his rallies. And so I don't really know. And, you know, not only that, he had this tweet about sending people to Bernie Sanders rallies. So I really don't know what other candidates could do to diminish that. It's not as if they can tell their supporters to not attend their own rallies. And it's not as if they ought to tell them not to protest. They should certainly tell them not to be violent. But that, I think, is something that all politicians should do.
So the question that keeps kind of looming in my mind is, at what point is Donald Trump accountable for violence that takes place at his rallies? I mean, he's sort of saying that he's just using his freedom of expression, both at a microphone and on social media, to express his opinions. But obviously they're inciting and encouraging violence. And I know you're not an attorney, and I'm not looking necessarily here for a legal answer. This is sort of a philosophical one. When is Trump accountable for situations if someone is critically injured at a rally, if someone is, God forbid, killed at a rally, if there's a riot that breaks out. I saw a headline this morning while preparing for the show that Trump believes there would be riots if he was not allowed to be nominated at the convention as the candidate. So there's this fear that he is feeding on from the authoritarians, but also this fear that he's spreading out there. So when is he accountable for that, or how can he be accountable for it?
So I actually am a lawyer.
That's right.
So I think that, you know, you've identified that there are two issues here. One is the issue of Donald Trump's free speech rights, and free speech does have limits in this country. And a key limit on it is that you're not allowed to say it's just free speech if you're actively and specifically inciting people to violence in a way that's likely to result in violence actually happening. And I really think that Trump is crossing that line because he's not just saying, you know, oh man, in my opinion, or something like that. He's saying, do this, I'll pay the legal fees. Seriously, please do this. So I think that really raises some concerns about whether he's crossed the line in terms of the First Amendment. But I think that the bigger issue here really is not his legal responsibility, but his what you could call his moral responsibility, which is he is somebody who commands the support of large numbers of very angry people who are very scared. And he, rather than trying to keep the situation calm and encouraging them to engage in peaceful protest and to, you know, show their support for him, their chosen candidate, peacefully, he is saying, if you see somebody throwing who looks like they might throw a tomato, punch them in the face. And even if that's not illegal, even if it isn't crossing the line of the First Amendment, it would still be wrong to do that. And I think the same is true of his, you know, statements that there would be riots in the streets. It's hard not to see that as a veiled threat, and it's hard not to see that as encouraging his supporters to do that.
You mentioned a moral obligation that Donald Trump has or should have, and I guess I wonder where morality fits into this authoritarian ideal. If you're motivated by fear, and fear is the prime motivator, where does morality fit in, or does morality take some sort of subjective form?
I think that you're right that the perceptions of it can be subjective. So what's really going on is that people are afraid and they think that this is kind of what you might think of as a self-defense situation, that there are circumstances that are so extreme that violence makes sense. But that doesn't make it true. And even if it might be satisfying to people to attack protesters who kind of embody the fears that they're worried about, you know, one of the things I wrote about in this article a couple of days ago about the violence at the rallies is that it was very striking to me the degree to which the people who were protesting at the rallies kind of were human embodiments of the kind of changes that people responding to our survey who were authoritarian said they were worried about. So they were Muslim students wearing headscarves, people wearing T-shirts about the Black Lives Matter movement. These are the kind of social changes that are very disturbing to authoritarians. Black Lives Matter is not just about racial justice. It's also about limiting the authority of police, which is disturbing to somebody who feels very strongly in kind of preserving authority and hierarchy. And we know from our survey as well that people are very concerned about the presence of Muslims in America. They fear them as an outgroup. And so I think that because Trump has been whipping up fears and saying, you know, you're right to be worried about this and we need to do something about it, that also has some responsibility for what's happening at these rallies when people show up and are kind of targeted with violence.
So looking ahead, how can anti-authoritarian forces, whether they be politicians or lawmakers in the Democratic Party, whether they be establishment Republicans who are worried about the future of the party, whether it be a neighbor who's trying to talk to a Trump supporter and find out more about why he or she supports Trump. Looking ahead, is there any way that we can sort of counteract or reverse this authoritarianism, or is it something that will continue to grow and proliferate even past this election cycle?
I think, unfortunately, it's something we should expect to grow and proliferate. I would certainly say that on an individual level, there's certainly a lot we can do to reach out to our friends and family members who might be feeling frightened about these changes and try to convince them that, you know, they don't need to worry. And more importantly, they don't need to embrace these harsh and punitive policies in response to their worries. You know, the fact is Syrian refugees are so thoroughly vetted that they just don't pose a security threat to the United States. The fact is that immigration, unauthorized immigration across the Mexican border right now is at net zero. There aren't actually people flooding in over that border. And I think it's certainly worth trying to engage with some of those fears and help people feel less concerned about them. But I don't think that changes the truth that there is this large block of authoritarian voters. They are now a powerful force within the Republican Party, and it's not at all clear what the GOP's path forward is to dealing with that.
Might authoritarianism be a generational development in the sense that, you know, we see a lot of Trump supporters are older Americans or Americans in older age or being senior citizens. We see, especially in the Bernie Sanders camp, the progressive camp, we see a lot of young millennial energy. I wonder, is it possible that that this could fade over a generation the same way that opposition to LGBT equality and same-sex marriage seems to have over time faded with the generation?
I think that there's a very real possibility of that. One thing that I found very interesting in our survey was that people who scored high in authoritarianism definitely skewed older, but also people who scored very low in authoritarianism, so people who selected all of the parenting answers that were the non-authoritarian answers, they skewed very young. And part of that might just be an age thing, you know, apart from anything else, that means they're less likely to have had children, so they might not have thought about those issues as clearly. But I think that if it is something that turns out to be accurate, that suggests that over time, authoritarianism could overall become a less powerful force within U.S. politics. But it also, I think, means that it would potentially be an even bigger difficulty for the Republican Party because it's not clear what the GOP can do to appeal to those non-authoritarian voters, particularly if it's trying to also tack its policies back and forth to appeal to the large group of authoritarian voters it already has.
Amanda Taub, she's a reporter for Vox.com covering foreign politics, human rights, and social justice. Her article, The Rise of American Authoritarianism, appeared on Vox.com earlier this month, and we have a link to it on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Amanda, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. We have technical direction from Tim Slover. Sophie Sorosis is our intern. Josh Weathers is a producer of Video West. Radio West is produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. Doug Fabrizio is the show's executive producer. I'm Terry Gilday.